Welcome to Couch Potato Theater, here on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this episode of Couch Potato Theater on the Fandom Podcast Network, we look at Jean-Claude Van Damme's amazing Hard Target, directed by John Woo, here with your hosts Adam and Brad, along with co-founders Kevin the Raider Nerd Weitzel and Kyle Wagner.
G'day, mate. How are you?
Good. How you going?
I'm good. I'm good. This is Adam and
Maga.
And we're here at Fandom Podcast Network to chat a bit of Van Damme.
Bit of Hard Target.
Bit of Hard Target. Bit of B.A.
Bit of Wet Mullet.
Bit of Wet Mullet. Bit of,
bit of Cajun kickfighting.
That's right. We're going to be here with, of course, the co-founders of the podcast to chat a little bit of Van Damme today. And who knows, you might learn a little bit about the movie itself too. Hey, Macca?
Yes, indeed.
All here on the Fandom Podcast Network.
Welcome to Fandom Podcast Network, your place for fandom, and we welcome all of it. Here at Couch Potato Theatre, we're going to be celebrating Hard Target on a Hard Target retrospective here today. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, along with my other host here today, Brad Macca. How are you?
Good, mate. How you going? Good. How is everybody?
Good, mate. How are you guys?
Well, we're doing good. Kevin, are you doing good?
Yeah, I'm doing really good. Excited to be talking about some Van Damme here, specifically one of my favorite films.
Awesome. Now, so joining us in the USA, we have the one, the only, Kyle Wagner, co-founder of the amazing channel here at Fandom Podcast Network, along with his other co-founder and amazing co-host here today, the one, the only, Kevin the Raider Nerd Weitzel. How are you?
Doesn't get old. Love that.
Never. I have a question. Do we have to do bad Cajun accents for this podcast? If so, I'm out. I'm just saying right now. You don't want that.
You just got to do the big palm.
Is it really bad, or is it just, you know, now it's just kind of, you know, fun, you know?
I don't know.
Have we accepted it's so bad that it's good? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it worked for him, didn't it? There was a lot worse that Van Damme did, I think, with his characters over the years. Yeah.
This one's a wet mullet movie, really.
It really is.
His mullet's wet pretty much all the time.
Yeah, I think there was someone's... I think there was someone's job, like, off camera to continuously spray his
wet. They have that spray bottle.
You gotta think it's a good movie because there's a gif of him punching that snake.
Yeah. It goes limp very slowly.
I think the snake is a podcast all on its own, Kevin.
Yeah. A Hard Target snake. Let's get him on.
The snake. He's got to get his own. All right, fellas. Well, we're here. And for all you listeners out there, we're going to be celebrating, I think, one of the greatest Van Damme movies. It's not just a Van Damme movie. It's a John Woo movie. And this is the first American John Woo film. So internationally jumps over and makes this film after making The Killer, Hard Boiled, all these great,
old school.
Yeah, Chow Yun-Fat.
Yeah.
And he was hardcore. You know, that was pretty much one of the big ones. But, of course, this is Van Damme's, I think, biggest film for the time. 1990s really saw him rise and become... It was major box office back then.
Well, those movies really were huge back then. They always pulled a big crowd, those old action films. Whenever they came out, it was always, it's a Van Damme movie, let's go see it, you know?
Mm.
It's almost like Marvel and Star Wars back then was Van Damme and Arnie and all those guys.
Yeah, Van Damme was pulling a lot of weight. He had a lot of... Apparently, he had a lot of influence on this film and the direction that it went. His star power was definitely reaching the top at this time.
Yeah, I also know for John Woo, this was huge. Yeah, this was huge with John Woo because, I mean, this was a big thing, John Woo finally doing American films, because nobody thought it would actually ever happen. And if they finally talked him into it, and this is kind of a start of his run of American films that I think a lot of people, unfortunately, are going to say wasn't as successful for John Woo as a lot of people thought it would be here in the States. Mm.
You know what John Woo's first question was when he came to the States to do a production? It was, what's an insurance company?
All right, before we get into the episode, guys, we're going to let you know how you, the listeners out there, can get in touch with Phantom Podcast Network, of course, us here as a team as well. So you can find Kevin at Kevin Rollaway.
Let us know. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Spartan_Phoenix.
Excellent. And we'll jump to Kyle. Kyle, where can the listeners find you?
You can find me on Twitter at AKyleW and on Instagram at AKyleFandom, a.k.a. Wet Mullet.
Awesome. Macca, where can the listeners find you on the afternoon?
Catch you? Facebook is Brad McNaughton, and then it's like, I always got to remember what my name is for this.
I thought it was America's Most Wanted, where we could find
something like that. And Macca_Brad on Instagram.
Awesome. Yeah, check that out. Also, you can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at Obi Pop Culture, but you can catch Phantom Podcast Network at fbnet.podbean.com. Or yep. Get the app. The app's even better because you can catch us and all those other great shows out there. Another one called Fant the Tracks. I don't know about that one. You can catch Phantom Podcast Network on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and Google Play. Also, you can catch us on the email. Let us know what you think of the show and obviously all the other great shows here, and of course, about what you'd like to see us do here at Phantom Podcast Network, phantompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. And you can also catch us on Instagram, Phantom Podcast Network, and Twitter at FanPod Network. So, before we get into it, I want to know from all of you, when you first saw the film, well, I know when Macca saw it because we both saw it together. Yeah, that was a huge one.
The Hyperdome.
But let's, Kyle, you take away, let's know when you first saw it and your first reaction.
I actually saw this in the theaters up in Alaska at the time. A bunch of us, this was really, like you guys said, at the height of Jean-Claude Van Damme being really popular and probably his biggest time as a box office draw. And you add in the general move factor, a bunch of us went and saw it. And I just remember coming out of it going, yeah, that was a little insane, but it was fun too. I mean, it was probably realistically, when you consider it was more fun than it probably should have been. What do you think, Kevin?
I saw this when it first came in the theater. John Woo for me was on my radar from seeing The Killer on VHS and Hard Boiled, and so I was really, really curious about his first American film, teaming up with the Muscles from Brussels, one of the biggest action stars at the time. And I was a big fan of Double Impact, the other film that Van Damme was in, where he played twin brothers. Just it's one of those guilty pleasures for me. I'm sure we'll come up again on this network. I saw it in the theater, and I was like, I'm curious to see how they're going to do this. And I was pleasantly surprised that it was fun. It was done well, and I got my John Woo out of it, and I got my violence out of it.
So, Macca, we saw it at high school, didn't we?
Yeah. I remember that.
The day, like, we expected just another VHS-like film, didn't we? And I both reckon we must have walked out of that going, the hell did we just see? Like, we were pretty gobsmacked, weren't we?
It was a strange way to watch Van Damme, all the slow-mo and everything. Like, all the triple kicks when he's only kicking once, and the close-ups of his boot hitting faces and stuff. It was really strange.
Yeah, you know what's funny is that when Macca and I saw that first scene where he's, you know, cleaning up the French Quarter and he throws that dude into the parking meter, right? Oh, yeah. And we're just cacking ourselves. Kind of like, because when we watch an action film, we're like, yeah! You know, okay. And just like, everyone's going, hey, that's a really good action. We're like, it's funny, man. It's really good. Dude got what he deserves.
It's interesting you bring up that particular scene where he's he's taking Nat Binder and protecting her from those thugs that are after her purse. You're used to John Woo and his action scenes when it comes to gunplay, but if you really think about it, he really let Van Damme be Van Damme in this and let him do his martial arts. And when you see in this movie, I seem to really remember, this is the first time anywhere I remember seeing people making contact with other people's body parts to get the slow motion kick or punch to the face. He's actually making contact with these guys. And oh, yeah. So you got to give it up for the stunt team. But this was the first time I really remember seeing video of like foot to face or, you know, fist to face type contact. And that was a big deal for an action fan.
Yeah. I want to throw in too, I remember here, I rewatched this right before we did this, and you look at that slow motion, and really that was slow motion like that in an action film was not something that Americans were used to at all at that point. But slow motion action film was, slow motion was just not something you saw in a film. And then John Woo really, that was one thing John Woo brought along with him. But, you know, you had to have complete trust in Jean-Claude Van Damme with his martial arts skills to make those slow motion shots, because that it was a slow motion shot, but he was going at a decent speed with that. The only bad thing I'll say with the slow motion, especially at that time, is there are a couple times where the slow motion really reveals some bad effects too. There's the scene in that same fight where he dislocates the guy's arm, and it's very obvious he's got a fake arm in his possession there. But I mean, still at the time that was just unheard of, and it was a big game changer for Hollywood at that point.
Definitely.
And as Sean Spudro says, you know, about that scene where the arm is still sticking, it was a tragedy. All right, let's talk about the actual the plot itself. So I'll give you a quick rundown for the listeners. It's a 1993 American action film directed by Hong Kong film director John Woo. So obviously his American debut. Jean-Claude Van Damme plays Jean Spudreau. That's right. His mama took a chance. An out-of-work Cajun merchant marine. And he saves a young woman by the name of Nat. Of course, what is a Nat? You know, we find out in the movie. Natasha Binder. So she's got a gang of thugs in New Orleans after her. And that's because she's looking for a missing father, played by Chuck Ferrer, who we're going to talk about very, very soon, and you'll know why. And agrees to aid Binder in his search. So Baudreau and Binder soon learn that Binder's father was died at the hands of a wealthy sportsman, mate, Emil Fouchon, played by Lance Henriksen, who I think is actually pretty interesting in this one. You know, like, and I think you guys will all have your own trivia on him, but it's his henchman. I think that it gets most of the best lines in this film, of course.
That's his name, Vosloo.
Vosloo, yeah. Hey, Denny, this is Ithaca, you know, from...
Wakey, wakey.
Blood Diamond, you know. Like,
and Vosloo also was Destro in G.I. Joe, wasn't he?
He was, yes, too, yeah. So, yeah,
of course, you can't forget him from his role in The Mummy, either.
Yeah. I reckon he's a really good villain, old Vosloo. Yeah. He's really good.
And obviously they're the cornerstone of what is a myriad of great bad guys in this film, because we don't just get the one, we get a real sports
boy. Yeah, we get old mate Sven.
Sven's got a role. And there's that dude from Twins that tries to bear hug Arnie, and Arnie just goes, crack, nyah, you know, and takes him out. He's in this one too. He goes, you're an effing buffalo. Remember that? He does it in the movie.
So the Lance Hendrickson, though, man. Lance Hendrickson.
Oh, yeah.
He was evil in this.
It was strange to see him in a movie with Van Damme.
And to be flamboyant bad guy. Even with the hunting pistol, that pistol these guys are amazing. But, of course, this is basically based on The Most Dangerous Game, which you can see in the Michael Dudikoff film, The Avenging Force, with, was it Steve James? Steve James did that from American Ninja as well.
Yeah.
So, The big fella. He should have been Blade.
He was awesome, that guy. I used to love that guy.
He was amazing.
Nick Fury.
Oh, just amazing. So, obviously, the story is about hunting humans. So, it's kind of, there's a touchstone of maybe Predator there as well. But let's have a look at the story itself. What do you guys think? We'll start with you, Kyle, about the actual story itself. It's pretty hardcore action story, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you're talking about basically hunting humans for sport, it's a hardcore action film. One of the things that I really liked about this, and it's a place that movies haven't really gone to a whole lot, is the New Orleans setting and the Cajun setting. And I think, you know, we haven't seen too many movies that really have played up on this. And this film actually does a pretty good job of playing up on that aspect. But there's a lot of great late 80s, early 90s things with this film, as far as the action type sequences, where you've got some pretty good action because you have the John Woo thing, but you still have some of the over the top action sequences too. The one that always comes to mind in this film is when Van Damme is literally almost surfing on the motorbike going towards the
car.
But this movie had that great balance, and you had, especially with from the opening scene on, where you're going right into that to one of their hunts, you know, it kind of sets the tone for the film right out of the gate. And I think that works really well in this case.
It certainly does.
Regarding the story, to me, it was fascinating because I don't remember really seeing another movie at the time that zeroed in on humans hunting other humans. And I thought that was fascinating story-wise. Being set in New Orleans at the time really had an effect on me, but as of lately, a lot of production has moved to New Orleans. It's kind of become a secondary Hollywood next to Atlanta, Georgia. There's a lot of shooting going on here now. But if you look, a lot of films are being filmed here in New Orleans. But what's kind of ironic is that it kind of almost, the story of humans hunting humans kind of started a trend, because the following year, another movie came out called Surviving the Game. With Ice-T as the lead, and Gary Busey, and where they hunt a guy.
F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Charles Dutton. Yeah, yeah. John C. McGinley, as we like. The story wise, I thought I was one of the most intriguing parts to me, and I was kind of curious to see how Van Damme would do, and it was a good story to give to John Woo, if you ask me.
I think one of the greatest things about movies like that, yes, we got, as you say, Kevin, Surviving the Game, which was kind of a sleeper hit even out here, and all great actors in it as well. It showed, just like Hard Target, you can have an absolute smorgasbord of amazing, talented people in a pretty hardcore setting. And if you've got the prize being humans, you know, that you're going to try and take out, you'll do anything. And I think that's what makes it such an important story.
Go ahead, Kyle. No, I would agree. But Kevin, I mean, you brought up a good point, because it seems like, I almost kind of think Hard Target in a way kind of opened up the doors to certain kinds of movies with that, Kevin. What do you think on that?
Yeah, I would agree. It also pushed the envelope of violence. It really did. And I wanted to bring this up because I stepped away for a second because I wanted to get this out of the I had this sitting over on the shelf. When this edit came out, there was like a good two and a half hour version, maybe even 3 hours to start, you know. But Wu had trouble getting past the rating censor over here in the States, and he had to cut it down. And so, when you go to conventions, they have these like bootleg versions of films. And I got this Van Damme Hard Target version here. I'll hold up to the camera so you guys can see it.
What the hell? 22 minutes of extra footage.
Yeah, uncut, unrated, 22 minutes of extra footage. But what's funny is on the back of it, it says, without a doubt, the most outrageous cutting catastrophe that ever occurred over the last couple of years have been with John Woo's film Hard Target. When it was first announced that Woo would be bringing his two-fisted style of action to U.S., fans weren't too optimistic, and few believed his style would survive the East-to-West translation. So was it really that bad? Yes. And it goes on to say that by the time the smoke had cleared, it seemed everyone associated with the film, Universal and the MPAA, which is the ratings company, had made their own personal cut. The only ones who really suffered were audiences who were forced to watch the atrocity edited 94-minute print. But with this one here, it brings it up to 116 minutes. So, and the last time I watched this, you know, when it comes to story-wise, it didn't really add much to it. It just, there was a lot more violence to it. Like, especially the ear cutting scene. Mm-hmm. That one was a lot more graphic.
I think one of the great things about this film is that it kind of feels, I think, actually, Macca, we talked about this that long ago when it first came out. It almost feels like two movies.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah, because you've got right up to the point where Van Damme actually takes action. So, you know, he's kind of, it's almost like he's Batman. He's like a detective story, kind of. Yeah, like he's trying to figure it out.
He's trying to figure out what happened to Binder.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he's involved in the whole lot. So he's in those circles already. So he's kind of a little bit like Batman, really.
Yeah, is, isn't
just,
it?
Just not rich.
Yeah. So what I love about that is it's smart for a plot, because what you're doing is you're giving time to actually get to know not only the lead hero, so we get to know him through, because he's a man of few words, and those words are hard to decipher anyway. but when we actually get him going on this search, we get to know Lance Henriksen, Arnold Vosloo, and just the characters around those. I mean, Elijah's another character, which we'll talk about soon when we talk about the cast. But it shows you more about why he would take action. And then finally when he does, when that first shotgun goes off in the middle of the French Quarter, and it's just literally that's breakneck speed. It's almost turns into that Mad Max speed. If you
doesn't
like.
Really stop from there.
Yeah, yeah. So it's because he now becomes the hunted.
Slows down a little bit when he gets to Uncle Duvet's house.
Yeah, yeah.
A little
yeah.
bit of a slowdown point there.
That's right. And Hollywood, Duvet needs a prequel. We need to see a young Duvet. Who would play a young Uncle Duvet?
you know, I want to bring up a point, too. When you talk about this movie kind of having two parts to it. In that first part, too, one of the things, and I had forgotten about this until I watched it again, there's a lot of social commentary in that first part of Hard Target, especially dealing with like the homeless, what happens to some of our military veterans, which is now I know of a bigger topic. But you know, there's the one scene where we see the death of the Elijah Roper character, and he's trying to get help, and everybody's trying to just like saying, "No, I don't have change. I don't have change, or leave me alone." They're acting scared, and he just kind of comes to this realization: is like, I don't want to live like this anymore. And he just accepts his fate and he gets killed. But that's actually, I actually forgot about that moment in the film because it's been so long since I've watched Hard Target. I'm like, that's actually a really powerful moment and a really big social commentary that even fits in today's society.
Definitely.
Oh, it's huge. I think for any country with anyone who's served their country, served the people, bringing freedom to those who are living in those countries, We need to respect them a lot better. I mean, I'm the son of a stepson of a veteran myself, and you can see that in Brad Vibwise, And I think the Australian government's got a lot to pay alone for just giving them the welfare that they need and the better life. But I agree. I think too, we get to see New Orleans, not just in what we've seen in, say, the James Bond films. Was it Live and Let Die that we saw?
Yeah.
So we get to see more of not just the French Quarter, but we get to see the marine area, so where they're actually doing the docks and stuff like that. I thought that was actually handled quite realistically. I've worked on the docks myself, so seeing that sort of stuff. We got to see that and the bayou, which we don't know much of out here.
In Australia. It was different to see in an action.
It was, right. Yeah. What other movies, Kevin, can you think of where the bayou's been used like that?
Oh gosh, off the top of my head. Oof. Wasn't Southern Comfort, wasn't that a film with Powers Booth, Kyle?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's been a lot of movies. I mean, even James Bond, Roger Moore went to New Orleans, because what a lot of you may not know, when you go to New Orleans, you go down to the French Quarter. And I remember I took a cheesy vampire tour there once, which was a lot of fun, because there's a lot of vampiric-type crimes that took place over the last couple hundred years because of a lot of the immigrants that would immigrate there. Anne Rice, she has a home there, the vampire was filmed there. But what a lot of people don't know is when you go to New Orleans, when you see these houses that have these columns, that look very, very New Orleans, and they have certain like facades and paint jobs, if you own one of those houses, you're not allowed to change the look of that house. You're not allowed to add another floor. You're not allowed to change the front of your house. The color that your house is painted, it has to stay that color. You have to get special permission to change that because they want New Orleans to look the same for the next few hundred years. That's part of the way that New Orleans is. And when they had Hurricane Katrina hurt New Orleans, they had to go back and like repair a lot of stuff and bring a lot of New Orleans back to the way that it used to look. So there's a certain mystique when stuff is filmed there because it looks a certain way. There's a certain culture. And one of the things too, that when you go to New Orleans, you know, obviously there's the alcohol, but one of the things too is the food there, gumbo, having gumbo there in the French Quarter is one of the most, greatest meals I've ever had in my life, you know? So there's a lot of culture there that they kind of touched on a little bit here in New Orleans. And then when you watch Hard Target, I think it's Lance's character or Arnold's character says something about how they liked working in New Orleans because basically it allowed them the freedom to do the type of crime that they were doing. So, and you know, the underworld of New Orleans has a long history in its own.
Very interesting. So let's have a look at the cast. Obviously, Jean-Claude Van Damme leads this film. Chance Boudreau, out of work, Cajun, who is basically a merchant marine at this stage of his career. He was also a Marine Corps Force Recon. And basically, Boudreau is basically a character in this. But he's got so many different people behind him that also give Uncle DeVay, obviously, Natasha, so I'll get to those too. But what do we think of Jean-Claude in this? Is this his best role, most fun role? What do you reckon?
I don't know. It's one of his best. It's up there with Unisols.
Kev?
Definitely. It's for me, it's definitely in my top three Van Damme films. Probably maybe my favorite next to Double Impact, where he plays twins. And then of course his most successful as in, I think, theatrical money returns, which was Time Cop.
Definitely. Yeah, I love Time Cop as well. It's a great one, that one.
Plus you get Max Walker, playing cricket. Yeah. And Cole?
I think I know it's not his biggest box office role, that was Time Cop, but I think a lot of people consider this one of his most well-known roles. I think it's usually this. A lot of people go with Bloodsport because that was his first role, and a lot of people just remember that film for bringing us Jean-Claude Van Damme. But I think this one was probably his most hyped film because of the John Woo connection and where he was at the time. I think he was solid in this movie, and, you know, he's just quirky enough that what he was doing in this film really worked for him.
Definitely. All right. Kev's going to love this. Emile Fouchon. I'm surprised. That's pretty much how they say it, I suppose. Played by Lance Henriksen, the man, Bishop. Kev, tell us all about it.
Oh, Lance Henriksen was perfectly casted in this. And I know that Lance was excited to work with John Woo, and he was familiar with his stuff. And I actually had a chance to meet Lance in the elevator at Dragon Con. And really, really nice guy. Of course, we know him from Aliens as Bishop. But one of my favorite roles of all time was Jesse Hooker in Near Dark. Great underrated vampire film with Paxton as well, Bill Paxton. You guys got to check that out. And of course, he was also in Terminator. He played Detective Hal Volkovich. But we've seen him in so many things, and I just thought what was interesting about his role in this film is that not only did he wasn't a two-dimensional bad guy. And I love the fact that he was running this business of not basically human trafficking, but human killing. But I love the fact that he had his own distinctive weapon, that one-shot pistol that he had where he had the little little ammo belt. And he used it quite effectively, I thought. And so that was another interesting thing to his character.
Actually, we have a bit of information. Brad, what was it on?
That's a Thompson Center Arms Contender single shot pistol, 40.45 to 70 cartridges. No sights at all.
So he's almost like shooting by.
That was interesting because you didn't see a lot of bad guys or good guys use any weapons like that before. Usually they have an automatic or, you know, something like that, or belt fed machine gun, but seeing a one shot type pistol, which is usually used for target practice or in this case, hunting. A lot of people use those for hunting. And sometimes you'll see weapons like that might have like a stock or a scope attached to it, but this one wasn't. And I thought that was kind of cool because it was kind of like his sporting weapon, you know?
I suppose it really shows up the idea that this is a sport. So thanks, Kevin, for letting us know about Lance's character there. Kyle, I want to know what you think about Pick Van Cleef, played by Arnold Vosloo. Obviously, we know the roles he's done. Don't you reckon he's probably one of the strongest characters in this film?
He is the over-the-top villain of this movie. I mean, he's the one who's got a little bit extra crazy. He's kind of the more die-hard, really go over the edge guy in this film. Of course, you know, we talked about a little earlier, all the great roles he's done. Real quick, I want to throw out another good, great role for Lance Henriksen was FBI agent Frank Black in the Chris Carter TV show Millennium.
Oh yeah. I keep forgetting about that.
Obviously,
to X-Files, obviously, too.
Yeah. But Vosloo was amazing in this film. You forget how long he's been around and how many things he's done. And when he pops up in something like this where maybe you haven't watched it in a while and you're like, oh, wait. So, no, he was great in this. And like I said, I think he was probably the perfect over-the-top villain in this film. So
his other great roles is obviously in The Mummy. He was great in The Mummy. And for G.I. Joe fans, for Zartan, he was Zartan as well.
You mean Destro?
I'm sorry.
No, he played Zartan. You're right.
Yeah. He also had a voice recently in Voltron. Did you know that, Kyle? Your TV series, Voltron?
Was he...
He was Ulaz.
Who was he?
Ulaz.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Is he? Yeah.
But yeah, he's an iconic actor, and he usually always plays the heavy, the bad guy, and he's so good at it.
So he also has something in common with Liam Neeson. Do you guys know what that is? It's a heroic role. He also played the Dark Man in Number 2 and 3. Yeah. So I think they were pretty much straight to VHS at the time or DVD films, but. I wonder if Chuck Farrah wrote those ones as well. Of course, we're talking about Douglas Binder, who is the nominated Navy SEAL here. We'll just jump to Chuck, because we've already talked about him off air, so we may as well. Plays Douglas Binder, Natasha's father, pretty much the MacGuffin of the movie. You know, they're all trying to find out what happened to poor old Chuck. And, at the end of the day, he is the linchpin for this movie.
Mm.
So, Kev, you brought up some great stuff.
He was in Steel Dawn.
Yes, he's done a couple of acting roles, but he's famous for his writing, and he wrote Red Planet, Dark Man, The Jackal, Barbed Wire. He did the screenplay for. He did Navy SEALs. He's been a producer on several of these films as well, but he's more known for being a part of SEAL Team 4 and 6. Which were the main anti-terrorist, SEAL teams there in the U.S., and they were shrouded in secrecy for many, many years. Richard Marcinko, former commander, I think it was, of one of those. Maybe they worked together, who knows. But this guy's been through the stuff. He knows what wartime is like and special ops, and so he was a natural to be brought into the film industry and to take and do roles like this, you know, so... They really got a guy that really knows his stuff, and I think that he's also a cancer survivor, by the way. But he also is he's written Warrior Soul, which was published in January of 2004. He details the service as a Navy SEAL of teams 4 and 6, including his role in the capture of terrorist Abu Abbas. So this guy knows his stuff. He was the right guy to bring in to do this role and also to help write it and produce it and stuff.
Mm. It's very surprising. You find out that the MacGuffin of the movie is literally not just the center, but the heart of the film. You know, it really is an interesting integral part of it. But you kind of think about, like, it's great that you got such realism then because, it's fanciful in the way John Woo does it because it's a more fantastical style, but choice of weaponry right on down, it feels like a true, way a hunter would do things, you know? So I think that's very interesting to do it. So we also have Willie C. Carpenter, which I've seen in a few other roles, plays Elijah, Chance Boudreau's friend, the homeless man in this. Kyle, what are your thoughts on Elijah?
Well, we've seen, that actor has been a very much a character actor through a lot of 80s films, and I mean, he was definitely set up to be kind of, he fit the role perfectly because he was set up to be the friend that kind of be the nice guy that gets into this and gets set up. And like I said, the moment he is killed in this film is probably one of the most poignant moments in the film, and yet incredibly sad as well. Not just because you're losing this character who came across as a very nice character, but why he decides to basically give up. And it's he portrays it in a way that it's a little bit soul crushing to watch this man who was an Army veteran and just a guy who lived life, and then he just kind of gives up and lets himself get killed right then and there on the spot. And it wasn't, like I said, for his brief time in this film, it was actually, ended up being a very powerful role in this film.
Mackie, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a good role for him, I think.
Pretty strong, like the fact that he gives a bit of realism to what people would go through on the streets, you know, but does it with a certain dignity, because he doesn't take any handouts or anything like that, and which is what I think the shattered soul of some of these homeless would be like. Kev, your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought he was the emotional attachment that you had to have in the film to the character that had to die to move the plot forward, whether it was getting revenge and having Van Damme realize he's got to stop these guys doing what they're doing, you know? So I thought he was a good choice. He's a character actor. I've seen him in a lot of stuff. But I do want to bring up a couple other characters, and you're probably going to get to them. I want to talk about Sven Ulf Thorsen. he was in this film. He played one of the henchmen, and he was the big guy that always had the cigar and had the very loud shirt on. But you recognized him in probably every single Arnold Schwarzenegger film, because they were friends, and he worked with him in Conan the Barbarian, Predator, Twins. You know, he's one of the bad guys in Predator. And he was also in The Quick and the Dead, The Hunt for Red October. I mean, he's been in so many stuff. And when you see this guy, you go, oh, I've seen this guy. I've seen that guy, you know. And he usually doesn't have a speaking role, although I think he did in The Running Man. He had, like, maybe one or two lines.
Is it Red Heat? Where he goes, Victor Oster, Truspa!
Yes, he's very, very distinctive. But, of course, we got to talk about the lovely Yancey Butler. She looked great in this film. She was Nat Binder, and we've seen her in a lot of stuff. She was in the Witchblade TV series, and then, of course, one of my other guilty pleasures, Drop Zone with Wesley Snipes. You know, she was also in Kick-Ass. I think she was the mobster's wife, if I remember correctly, in that.
She was.
But I liked her. I thought she was great. I thought she looked great in this film.
She did an action movie in the late 90s, not Witchblade. It was something else out here in Australia. I can't remember the name of, which tended to play on Fox a lot. And that's the last I saw of her, I think, in the before Kick-Ass.
She actually went through a lot of addiction problems after Witchblade. Witchblade, and she went through a lot of personal problems and addiction problems. And just really, in the last few years, really kind of come back onto the Hollywood scene.
That's true. Obviously, we can't go anywhere without Uncle Duvet, Wilford Brimley, Diabetes. You know,
he's the thing.
He is the thing. But
he's still the thing.
Yeah, let's put this out there. He gets a lot of crap for his supposedly bad Cajun accent.
I thought it was quite good in that. It was really good. And, I mean, here's a role. Wilford playing, you know, obviously, who knows, probably a World War II veteran in this movie, I suppose, something like that. He's obviously, you know, somebody that lives off the land. But I love it. I love the fact that he's kind of like that the grizzly bear, waiting out there.
Makes his moonshine.
Yeah. And is that not lethal when he goes, he's the Robin Hood of New Orleans.
You know, the crazy thing is, I mean, truthfully, Wilford Brimley is an amazing actor. He's done so many amazing roles, but the fact that he was willing to take on this crazy role, and you could tell he was probably just having an absolute blast with it. He's like, I'm just going to just pan this up as much as I possibly can.
Well, he has an extensive career. You know, he was in Cocoon, he was in The Firm, and wasn't he in a certain Ewok film? Wasn't he?
He was. They got rid of Mace Tawani, and they said, let's just get that dude from the diabetes ads.
Ewoks, the Battle for Endor. He played Noah.
That's the one. Yeah. But we look at some of the other actors we don't know too well, but we've got Randall Poe, obviously, who plays the recruiter for Fuchon, goes through and tries to get people to take part in the game, played by Elliot Keener. Now, that big guy, I've seen him in a number of things, but I always thought it was the guy from Total Recall, Arnie's buddy that gets him involved in all that. Nah. But obviously, different guy, yeah. But similar role, where we got somebody who's putting up the money to try and, you know, edge people into doing things. A little bit like Rutger Hauer.
He's the one that's recruiting the homeless people to be possible targets.
Mm. That's right. He's really the one that stuffed up, because they went, oh, let's get this other guy. He's got no ties. Had no idea. Chance Boudreau. He's actually somebody he knows well. Best buddy, you know. So he kind of stuffed up. But look at some of the names. You've got Mr. Lepaki, who plays the guy who, like a banker, who comes in and says, I want to go kill him. I thought he did it quite well. It looks like somebody that's rich, obnoxious, and tries to get into it. You've got Frick and Frack, who I think must be those dudes. Get out of town, Boudreau. Do it today.
Those two.
Hey, that girlfriend of yours, and point her something's north.
Step on the gas.
Dr. Morton, he was quite good in it too.
He
goes, what a funny little man, eh?
What a funny little man.
And then, of course, you've got Xenon as well, who is played by Joe Warfield. So, look.
You just reminded me of that face that Boss Lou makes when he blows old mate's head off.
He
gives that little sort of,
He's got some quite big moments in the film.
It's really funny.
So, let's get to look at the development itself. Obviously, this is a film by Universal Pictures. Probably biggest in the 90s. Not quite as big these days, I suppose. They're not up there with Disney stuff now. Who knows? Disney might buy them, so who knows? After making Hard Boiled, John Woo decided to take a chance in the United States. And why not? Woo's first job, obviously, looking through Tom Pollock to see what films were on offer after doing The Killer. And, of course, this script had been going around from Chuck Ferrer, and it looks like it would do well with a good action star. Mm. So that's one of the things that they brought through. But it had been offered to Andrew Davis, was interested in it as well. Can you imagine, at the time, you think about Andrew Davis, the original actor that we used to work with him was a certain ponytailed actor. If you think back, Steven Seagal.
Was he the director that did Fugitive?
Yeah, correct. And Above the Law and Mark, not Mark for Death. He did like the first Van Damme, and I think he did the Under Siege film. The first one. And originally was the one slated to direct Running Man, but had a fallout with Arnold, and I think it was Starsky from Starsky and Hutch ended up there. So it's funny how that goes.
They wanted Kurt Russell for Van Damme's role.
Yeah, look at that. Yeah. So originally, Shrance Boudreau, whether it was going to be that character's name originally, but you would have heard another mullet.
Yes. Kurt Russell.
What do you think about Kurt Russell? Could Kurt Russell pull this off? Kyle, what do you reckon?
It would have been a totally different style of film. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't know if it would have been better or worked with this film. I know that when Woo was brought on, he had reservations about working with Jean-Claude Van Damme until he actually started working with him and saw how much Jean-Claude Van Damme was willing to do in the action sequences. And I don't necessarily know that Kurt Russell would have made the same kind of commitment at that point in his career. So
I'm going to say no. I don't think about it like this.
Jack Burton could have come along in his truck and just gotten involved.
I don't think this would have worked with Kurt Russell. Kurt Russell doesn't have the martial arts that really that Van Damme brought to this film. You know,
no, it would have had to be more firearms focused, I think. A little bit more guns, and it'd be more a comedy. I think you can't really do it more a serious action movie like that.
I can't see Kurt pulling that off either. No matter how they twist it, I don't think he would have fit in the bayou for some reason. I think it just wouldn't have worked for him for some reason.
So look at this, fella. So here's a little bit about how Chuck wrote this movie. So it's a quote from Wikipedia. It's Chuck Ferrer wrote the script, originally basing it on the film The Naked Prey, I suppose based on humans being hunted. After the script did not turn out, Ferrer worked on a script influenced by the film Aliens, that became the basis for the comic Virus. So that might be worth having a look at, see what that comic's like. The final attempt was a script based on the 1932 film The Most Dangerous Game. And, of course, the idea that Van Damme's involvement then changed the location to New Orleans to fit within his French-speaking accent. Interesting. How's that?
This movie has such a weird history involved with it when you think about it. Not only this, I mean, the fact that it was Woo's first film, but, you know, I know the people at Universal and behind it weren't exactly 100% sure if they could trust Woo or not, and there was a lot of concern about that, and I know they also just kind of help almost translate between Woo and the actors. They did bring in Sam Raimi to help with this, too.
Yeah.
I got no change, man. Yeah, Universal was afraid that John Woo's limited English would be a problem on the set, so they hired Sam Raimi to oversee the entire shoot and replace Woo if need be, which is why you see a brief cameo of Ted Raimi on the street when he's ignoring the guy the guy's asking for help when he's getting hunted. But I think that Sam Raimi knew what John Woo was up to, and I think he just kind of let him do his thing. But you know, the studio wanted to make sure that someone was kind of keeping an eye on John Woo in case he dropped the ball. So,
now the film itself shot obviously in New Orleans in the French Quarter for 74 days production time. So it's a pretty long shoot. Think about it.
Not really. That's a pretty short shoot, man. That's only just over 2 months, really.
I suppose like
that's pretty short. Considering an action film.
And was it, so 65 days of physical shooting time?
That's just for Van Damme.
But that'd be just Van Damme. Yeah, I'd say that's just Van Damme. Just for his ego and his big head. But interesting that obviously the cinematographer Russell Carpenter, which I've heard that name quite frequently around action films of that period, he said this will be the second part of shot. And to get his message across to Carpenter, got those sorts of things where he wanted to basically. John Woo and him had that sort of coming in from almost like a fandom perspective of how to sell out his shots. Basically.
Yeah.
So isn't that an interesting way to communicate, Kev? What do you reckon about that? Like as a fan saying to John Woo would say, look, I love this Western shot. Can you do it like this, please, Russell?
Yeah, he has his own style. And I think that, I don't know if American audiences really kind of understood that at the time, that weren't familiar with his work, And so if you're going to bring anyone in, which kind of surprised me that they didn't have the faith in John Woo that they had to bring in Sam Raimi to kind of keep an eye on him. I mean, didn't they not see his films? I mean, this guy, if anyone knows how to direct a lot of people with a lot of dangerous gunplay and action scenes, to say that he is the master. He's the one that knows this more than anyone. So, he has his own style, and I think you just got to kind of let him run with it.
Yeah. I know one of the things with this too is when this movie came out, a lot of John Woo fans were actually somewhat disappointed in this movie because it really was a toned down John Woo film.
Yeah.
You had those elements, you had the slow motion shots, you had some classic John Woo things, you even had a dove in it. But yeah, a lot of people were really actually kind of disappointed that this film wasn't more of the Woo over the top, and really didn't get that until we got Face Off when that came out. That a lot that of people like really consider that. Yeah, that a lot of people really consider Face Off really the first time we see a true John Woo film in America, as far as something he made there. So that was one of the things I think why this movie kind of didn't do that great when it came out in the theaters was. That a lot of people, after seeing it, the word of mouth was, it's not really a John Woo film. A lot of people felt that way about it.
And one of the interesting things while shooting the action sequences was obviously using a lot of firearms. So one of the big things with the the firearms is that it was going to be super dangerous. And, one of the big things was they used a special dolly created by John Woo called the John Woo Woo Choo Choo.
The
bulletproof one. So it had to have certain plexiglass on there so that the cameraman wouldn't get, damaged through, obviously, all this, and it was safe. But a lot of those scenes had to have that move so quickly to get the slow motion done.
I'm sure John Woo was looking at the camera setup for this film going, yeah, we need to protect these cameras a little more. Trust me, I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, Macca's got something here with Broken Arrow. Oh,
Broken Arrow is a John Woo movie.
Yes, yeah. It was.
Yeah, yeah. That was the different one as well. And that's that was kind of
the last one. Hit and miss. 2004, he did Ben Affleck's Paycheck. That was an American production. But apparently, he is working on the American remake of The Killer, which has been on the back burner for a long time. They've been wanting to do a remake of The Killer, and it looks like that it's in pre-production right now.
Oh, well, that's interesting, isn't it? It's coming through. So the film itself was edited by Bob Murawski, and it was one of the first using state-of-the-art computerized editing, I suppose like those Lucasfilm suites that they use on those. The film was also scored by Graham Revell and utilized, and this is, I love the music at the start of the film, particularly the Kodo drummers from Japan. Mm. There's the big timpani, yeah. It's just huge, taiko and stuff. But Wu ended up re-editing the film 6 times. Now, this brings us to, obviously, as Kev said earlier, quite a longer film that he envisioned, originally. But I think even the one we saw in the cinemas out here in Australia was probably longer than the US cut.
I wanted to mention, you had talked about Graham Revell doing the music. Graham Revell, for me, came on my radar because he did the musical score for The Crow, Brandon Lee's The Crow.
Yep.
And in addition to that soundtrack with all of the artists and their songs, which is probably one of the greatest movie soundtracks of all time, he did a really good job of the score. And so it was nice to kind of go back and look at Graham's stuff. And he's done a lot of stuff since then, but it was cool that he also was part of Hard Target.
Mm. So as we get, obviously, towards the end of how this film was put through, we're going to actually talk about some of the trivia that we found now. All of us have got a little bit of trivia to go through, so we'll go one by one. We'll start with you, Macca. You got a little bit of interesting trivia there. Give us one and we'll go around in a circle.
Well, it says here that Lance's coat actually caught on fire, and that's why he throws it off. So he stayed in character and threw the coat away. His coat wasn't actually supposed to catch fire.
It looks pretty realistic.
Yeah, but he's got all the slop and stuff all over him, so job. I don't know about that.
Because he had that shine to him, didn't he?
Yeah.
Kev, do you have any trivia there? Go one by one there.
Yeah, the body count was 34, which included the snake.
Kyle?
Well, I don't want to talk trivia, but I do want to talk about that snake for a second, because that snake might be one of the most famous snakes in film, because one, it was such an outrageously bad-looking special effect. But two, he bites the rattle off a rattlesnake like he was biting a piece of chicken.
Well, that was actually a trick back in the day if you wanted to set up a trap so it wouldn't give away the snake's position. Was that?
Oh, no, I
take the rattle off.
I agree, but I mean, he just did it so easily. Like, hey!
I wanted to ask you guys this. I want you guys all to chime in on this because I was thinking about this. Because one of the trivia things that I didn't know about was that in John Woo's original cut, there was a love scene between Chance and Nat. Let me ask you something. John Woo films aren't really known for having love scenes. Usually that there is a romantic interest. We saw that in The Killer. We saw a little tiny bit of that in Hard Boiled. But do you think having a love scene between the two main characters with Yancey Butler and Jean-Claude Van Damme, do you think that would have added to it or just was more distracting? What do you think?
I think it would have cheapened it a little bit.
Yeah.
Kind of between the characters, would have made it a little bit cheesy.
No room for love, Dr. Jones!
Yeah.
I think a distraction as well, yeah.
They're chalk and cheese, the two characters. She's this little princess kind of thing from the city, and he's this tough ass character in the bayou. I think them getting together would be a bit much.
Well, even Diva says the best. She's out of her element. He goes, "No killing for you."
See, and the thing was, is in this film too, I just don't think it would have been a good idea to hook him up because of how the relationship was. I almost felt like there were times where where John Woo was kind of indicating maybe there was more of a relationship between Van Damme's character of Chance and the detective that was in the film, the female detective.
Yeah. What's her name?
Casey Lemons.
Yeah, that's it.
And wasn't she in Silence of the Lambs as one of the recruits at the start?
Yeah, isn't she in...
She wanted to direct some stuff too, I know that, but yeah.
Mm.
I think I've seen her in TV as well.
That's not who I'm thinking of, but she was in Silence of the Lambs, Candyman. She was in quite a few things.
And she's quite good in her role. The fact that she's an overworked cop, probably the only one that stayed there that's not on... Because weren't they on picketing out for...
They were on strike. That's a very key piece of this film. They were able to get it. One of the reasons why Lance Henriksen was there is because he was able to get away with it because the police force was on strike.
Yeah.
Is that just a thing in the States? Do police always strike over there? Because they never do here. It's only teachers.
It's actually very rare that the police go on strike.
It is very rare.
Yeah. Only in
Detroit. You see that more in Paris.
Detroit, yeah, RCP! RCP run the cops! All right. Mackie, you got another bit of trivia there, buddy?
Right, let's have a look.
See if we can find something rare. What have we got?
Not really much that's all that interesting in.
Yeah, this movie, there wasn't a lot of trivia with this movie because there were so many people know the stories behind it already. I mean, it's one of those, it's one of the more bizarre Hollywood filming exploits because it was such a big name director coming over and the studio just wouldn't leave him alone to do this film. And, you know, it really truly is amazing in ways that this film actually got even out. And when it did, I mean, again, I remember being
so well. It made $32 million in the US and 74 worldwide, which was a lot of money for a like pretty much a B grade action movie.
Yeah. It had a huge success on video too here in the States.
Yeah.
It was huge on video here.
I always wanted to see an official re-release of this, whether it was the director's cut or something. I wish that John Woo would have sanctioned something like that, you know.
Have you guys got a Blu-ray over there of it?
Yeah, we have a Blu-ray of it, but there's no special, you know, there's no extended.
No special features.
It's just a transfer, you know. There's no special features to it.
Isn't the one out here is the same?
It'd be nice to see some special features on the stunts and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, but one of the scenes that I thought was funny, you know, towards the end when they're in that warehouse with all of the old Mardi Gras parades that are slowly dying and dying. The Sven guy gets shot by Van Damme's character, but Van Damme is holding the Beretta upside down and he has his finger in the trigger guard and he's pulling it back like he's rapid firing. It's like, why is he holding it upside down? Couldn't he just hold it up the other way as well and do the same?
The way he caught it.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
Well, one of the reasons, too, why you don't have a lot of special features on this movie is when John Woo came to the States, John Woo's always been pretty secretive about his filming methods. And he was even more so here in the States because he didn't exactly have trust of the studio himself either. It wasn't until later when he did like Face Off and a few of the more other American films that people kind of got more of a feel and got an understanding of his filming techniques. But early on, especially, John Woo was very secretive of how he did a lot of his filming techniques. Mm. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why you haven't seen a lot of special feature stuff on Hard Target.
That is true, yeah.
It is. And one of the key things in this film is, obviously, it's about kicks, punches, and throws, and breaking arms. But, as you mentioned it, one of the biggest stars is the Beretta 92FS. Almost every single person is using a Beretta, whether it's a chromed one, a silvered one, which we see, which is, I suppose, a nod to Hard Boiled because they use one in that one. But you've also got the Glock 19 used by Arnold Vosloo. But what's interesting is we also have him using a very old Ruger as Pick Van Cleef, and he uses that with a silencer when he takes out the Doctor.
Yes.
Which has that, ooh, what a funny little man, eh? and you get kind of a little bit of the creepiness of this character. Mm. I think it comes through, again, it's a little bit quite costumes. I think the firearm choices in this are telling of the characters.
Definitely.
The Beretta that you speak of became very, very, probably one of the most famous handguns because two famous action heroes used them prominently, and that would be John McClane in Die Hard. And then, of course, in Lethal Weapon, that was Mel Gibson's weapon as well. And that firearm was also was a standard U.S. military issued firearm because it had a high magazine capacity, but also a wide ejection port, which stopped a lot of jams from happening.
Mm. Let's talk about the big old FN Foul.
Foul, yeah. Yes.
Carried by Billy Bob, the guy that gets called Buffalo. It's a big gun. It's got the extended 21-inch barrel. It's a massive thing. But it doesn't look all that big in that dude's hands. That's funny.
Yeah, and the fact that this is... Literally, you take this, put a wooden stock on it, turn it to semi-auto, and it's what the Aussies carried in Vietnam. So when they, unlike the US troops who were using M16s,
SLR, self-loading rifle.
That's right. And what they would do is they fight a 7.62 round like the M14. So when they hit something, they put it down for good. but the FFL is an automatic version, if I remember right. Yeah. Now we've got the guy with the look, kind of looks like the Sam Elliott in this movie.
Yeah.
Jules Sylvester, the actor's name is. Was it a Type 56 AK?
No, it's Norinco.
Is it a knockoff?
Chinese ripoff of the AK.
Ah, there you go. Yeah, yeah. And then Sven gets the Valmet M78. Looks like, was it a sniper rifle?
Which is kind of silly because it is a sniper rifle. Yeah. Considering what he's doing, that's not an appropriate weapon.
Ethan says,
it looks there, very cool, though.
Converted to full auto on a sniper rifle.
Yeah, kind of silly. Full auto with a scope.
With a 15 round mag, is it?
Yeah, so that's going to work.
But it's a 308, so it'll I don't know.
Certainly put a hole in you.
Now, let's talk about Duvet. Oh. He doesn't have the 38.6, a gator eat it.
He's got the shiny Mossberg 590 Mariner. Yes.
Yes,
this gun, I think it would actually be built to be carried on a boat, because is this not the same one that Striking Distance?
Oh, yeah. So it might be something that's used around, just the boat.
That's why I think it's nickel-coated, is to stop rust and everything. That's
Yeah, water gets into it. Good point.
Where are you guys getting your cool gun trivia?
This is
IMFDB, Internet Movie Firearms Database.
Oh, that's a great place for that.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, Pick Van Cleef goes even more. He's got the spit-hole top cover. Mossberg 500.
Yeah, that's just the black version of the Mariner.
Mariner, isn't it?
But consider it, like, I was just like, look at that, Mariner. So it's obviously shotgun made for water.
That's perfect. It's almost like it was made to be. Oh, that's right. Old mate Billy Bob gets a street sweeper later on. The Cobra 12-gauge. Now, this has been used in how many films?
Lots.
Yes. I think it's Total Recall, Robocop.
Alien Nation.
Alien Nation, that's right. Remember at the start, he's got that, he goes, did you remember your vest? In the trunk of the car!
In the trunk of the car.
But yeah, in that scene, we see a shotgun with a rotary magazine, which we've never seen before. Like, it looks like a Tommy gun.
Yeah.
But it's just another place to put your
another thing you can call it is the striker.
So there's a lot of shotguns in this, and obviously that plays into a lot of the end of the film where he's picked the wrong weapon to save Matt.
Look at the right. What is that hunting? It's a massive shotgun duvet. The big side-by-side 12-gauge double-barrel shotgun puts it down.
The one thing that I've always liked about John Woo films, and even though the bullet count might be off a bit, they show reloading a lot. Which I always thought was interesting. Yeah.
They do reload.
And one of the things I noticed...
Van Damme towards the end.
Endless 20-round mags.
Well, you see Van Damme going around to the corpses he's killed and picking up extra magazines, reload his Berettas, and obviously you see Lance Hendrickson reload his one-shot weapon, but that's one of the things that he's always incorporated into his films, and until recently has been, I think, down to the bullet count. Chad Stahelski from the John Wick films really relies on his bullet count, making sure that the shots that you see come on screen match what actually goes inside the weapons. Seeing reloading done as many times, you didn't really see a lot of that in action films until like these John Woo films, you know?
Yeah. Well, in fact, reloading, that reminded
me. It looks really cool, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's you had that classic John Woo shot in this film that he's done before where you have the two guys facing off. In this case, it's Chance and Arnold Russell's character. They're back-to-back on an opposite side of a wall, and they're reloading talking to each other. And then it leads to the shootout through the wall, which is a classic John Woo staple.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Even hands him the grenade to end his boss with. Man, I thought that was quite good too. But Robert Apicia, who plays the guy with a bow and arrow, or crossbow, sorry, and says, I love that weapon too, because it kind of...
not actually a crossbow.
It's not a crossbow.
It's a launcher. It's called an arrow launcher. Yeah, it's not a crossbow.
Because there's no, there's no actual bow from
them. But that was Aero, Aero A8S Stealth.
That weapon was actually one of the things that was a signature point of this movie. Was which they was one of the big sells on this movie, and especially in the trailers, was that particular weapon.
Well, yeah, if you look at the cover of the video, it's the arrowhead and the reflection you see Van Damme's face, you know, and you see the slow motion of the arrow that is turning as it's going in for its kill, and we see
Uncle Duvet has a longbow.
Yeah.
I think it's just part of it. You know, you get down to it. It's about the hunt. And what a hunter's used for thousands of years, those weapons, you know.
Well, that's the silent, stealthy weapon.
Yeah, it is.
They still use them now.
That's right. So the film premiered August 20, 1993, wide release throughout the US, and second place grossing of $10,106,500 in its business showing in more than 1,900 locations. The film The Fugitive came in first place. So it was just on top of it. So you can kind of see that Andrew Davis jumped straight to The Fugitive when this movie came out.
This made $74 million. What did it cost? What did it cost to make this? What's the budget of the movie?
The budget was $18 million.
Well, that's a big success for an action movie like that.
For Van Damme, considering how much the other ones
made. Considering it's a B grade film, really. Like, realistically, you could class it as a B-grade film.
So, including Australia, domestically.
I don't know if for American audiences it felt like a B-grade film, especially with John Woo as the director. But I could definitely see how it's definitely not your Lethal Weapon or your Predator and stuff like that. So, it is definitely on the fringe of B-action film.
Yeah, you know, I think over time... I think over time it's kind of... in the lexicon kind of morphed into that direct-to-video VHS type action film, because so many people forget about its theatrical run, even though it had a successful theatrical run. Mm-hmm. So many people remember it from VHS release that I think that's where a lot of people, and because Van Damme has had such a, Van Damme has really been more of a success in the VHS end of things than he ever was really in the theater per se. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where this film kind of comes in.
It's kind of Kickboxer, Bloodsport, those are all very popular in video home release.
Yeah.
So I think that's where this film has kind of become like that, I don't want to say B movie, but like that VHS type classic film. So
it's almost cult, really, the following for Hard Target.
Yeah.
Considering John Woo Van Damme film.
I would totally elevate it to the B-plus action films.
B-plus. That sounds like a good show. Okay, in between.
But since we're talking about, you know, the cult status of Hard Target, it did finally get followed up on in 2015.
Yes, it did. Hard Target 2, baby.
With Tim Morrison, Jake the Musbrew. We're going to go up there and take out
Scott Adkins.
He was quite good in that. He holds the movie well.
I'm actually a huge fan of this. I wouldn't call it... One of my biggest pet peeves with sequels is that when they ride the popularity of the first one and they just put a 2 or 3 after it, when it has nothing to do with any of the previous characters, you know, I would have called it maybe Hard Target, you know, Malaysia or whatever this movie took place in. Myanmar, near Burma, actually. But Scott's...
Hard Target Singapore.
Hard Target Scotland. Take him out. No.
But I actually like this film. It was beautifully shot. Cinematography is great. And I'm becoming a huge fan of Scott Adkins. He's kind of become this kind of B action film hero. And you can see him in films like he was in Expendables 2. He played one of the bad guys. He also was one of the bad guys in Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's done a lot of...
That's not a small movie to be in.
Exactly. His role was smaller, and he played one of the bad guys, but he's been in a lot of great...
Who's the lead guy in that? Wasn't it Benedict Cumberbatch, the guy that can't say penguin? He goes, penguin.
Salad sandwich.
Penguin.
Yeah. But Scott Adkins, I think, is on the verge of maybe just finding that right film and getting into like the larger...
I think he needs to be paired with someone big.
Exactly.
He needs to be put in a movie with someone huge,
and
just to elevate him further.
The biggest co-star, The biggest co-stars in this film is the bad guy played by Robert Knepper. He's the Lance Hendrickson type character. What's funny is at the end of the film, he actually brings out that single shot weapon. He uses the same type of weapon.
That's cool. I like Robert Knepper. He's a good actor.
One of my movie crushes, Rona Mitra, is one of the people that is one of the hunters. And
you love Rona Mitra, don't you, buddy?
I do love my Rona Mitra. She's the person she's the person that I get if I can't get my movie wife. You know who she is, right, Kyle?
Kelly McGillis.
Oh yeah, the movie wife. No.
Kelly McGillis, shut up.
Yeah. Your wife.
Kate Beckinsale, baby.
Kevin Klein.
I'll agree with you on that one.
Yeah. Wait. No. Kevin Klein kept Kate Beckinsale as his movie wife, but he has yet to meet her in person. But I got him the autograph.
Yeah. But anyway, back to Hard Target 2. I highly recommend it. It's I think it stands on its own. It's really well shot. Directed by Roel Renee, he's done a lot of other B action films. But Scott Adkins is really good. You guys got to check him out. I think he's a bigger star in the making. I hope
he is. Now Van Damme had something to say about the actual film itself. When I do it in my best Van Damme. Hard Target was a bad script, but we had some great action scenes, and John Woo made me look like samurai with greasy hair. That's an actual quote from Van Damme.
Oh, Winter, I thought that was Van Damme reading that. Wow, that was
awesome. Let's have a look quickly at just some of the reviews of this film. Siskel and Ebert, Roger Ebert stating that Hard Target is not very smart and it's not very original, but is well made on a technical level. The stunts are impressive. And as an action picture, it's well made, but it never becomes a competent action. I just can't recommend it.
Yeah.
So that was the...
Yeah, I don't always agree with him.
No, same here.
Me either.
So we've also got Janet Maslin of the New York Times. She's actually got a pretty positive one. Swishing, whooshing, loved photography, weaponry, nasty gurgles from the wounded, and the clonking sound of a head hitting Ryan. A bullet in the eye. These are the cornerstones of Hard Target, one of the summer's few super bloodthirsty action films, and the one that actually stood a chance of rising above the genre. Mm. That's brilliant. And it pretty much nails what the movie's like.
Well, it was different for the time, and people weren't expecting it from Van Damme, and I think that's why maybe it got a bit of the backlash.
Mm. Was that the film where, see, Macro and I saw it, I think it was on the holiday period when that came out here. I can't remember exactly. It's definitely a weekend. We went in, watched it, and when we came out, I remember it might have been Mortal Kombat or something. There's something, a soundtrack that's playing in from one of the other theaters, because we were thinking of seeing that instead of Hard Target. Mm. And we walked out and we were like, that movie is just literally nailed it. Like,
it's insane.
It's insane.
You know, I'm not a fan of Rotten Tomatoes, but I was curious to see where Hard Target measured up. And I want to ask you a question, Kyle. Right now, they have the tomato meter at 53%, which isn't considered fresh. But for the audience score, 48% liked it. I guess, do you have to have like 60%? Have it fresh, I guess.
About 60% starts getting to hit that fresh. You know, 53 seems like about a right number, though, for Hard Target, as far as when I think about how people react to it. Because Hard Target is either going to be one of those movies that you absolutely love it, or you're just it's not your cup of tea. So I think it is a good 50-50 split on Hard and Target fandom. It's a fun movie. It is what it is. It knows what it is, which is always a great thing for a movie. It's fast paced. It draws you in. It's got some unique takes in it, and you know it's technically got a historical feeling to it because it is John Woo's first American film. So
it's a historical action film for us because this was right at the time, you know, when Van Damme was really getting to his big point. And he's one of the biggest action stars, so it's one of the best, I reckon. And you mentioned John Wick before. How about the fact that this has pigeons as well? And what did John Wick 2 have?
Pigeons. Yeah, that's right. Wow. And it looks like number 3's got pigeons in the desert.
Well, one of the reviews I see here that gave it a fresh on Rotten Tomatoes was a guy said that it was one of his greatest guilty pleasures. And I think this movie falls under that category for a lot of people.
Definitely.
You know, this is definitely a guilty pleasure, and we like it for so many reasons, you know.
Well, it's one of those movies you can put on and just go, yep, I'm going to have an action movie that's basically nonstop and I can enjoy it and sit here and have fun with it. You know, it's not something you're going to sit there and take seriously, is it? I mean, you're not going to expect Leonard Maltin to buy a copy, are you? Like,
yeah.
I think he gave it a fair rating, actually, if I remember right. But, yeah, no, it was great. It was an enjoyable film, and I think for us it was good to see Van Damme take that next slice. Mm-hmm. I mean, next thing after this was Time Cop. Yeah. You know, we had Nowhere to Run.
I got to say, Time Cop would have to be my favorite Jean-Claude Van Damme, I think. After you melt them all down, Time Cop's probably his best standalone movie as a him leading it.
Well, it's just a little that's short. Let's talk about that. We were talking about that before we started recording. Let's put in our top three Van Damme films. Back and start with you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'd have to say Time Cop is at the top. Second, I got to say, for a lead, it has to be Hard Target for a second, but I would maybe slot Universal Soldier in there.
Right.
Third, wow.
You got to go the sport, dude.
You got to go Bloodsport. You have to. Or Kickboxer. Those two are kind of even for me, I think. But Bloodsport takes it for the nostalgia value.
I'm going to go. Look, Time Cop and Hard Target are hard to beat. Those two are the top for me. But I'm going to go a little bit different here. I'm going to go back a few years and going to say Death Warrant's quite an interesting portrayal. He tried something a bit different because he had to act in
the prison.
The prison, which is hard.
It was a different thing for him. It was a different role. Because that was one of those movies you sort of walked out of going, did we just watch a
Van What about you, Kyle? Yeah. Kyle, what are your favorite three favorite Van Damme films?
Okay, well, I break this down into two categories. The insane Van Damme films and the legitimate Van Damme films. Okay, so the insane Van Damme films, come on, Double Team with Dennis Rodman.
I know that's not in your top three, though, man. Come on.
No, it's not in my top three. Give me my top
three. You cannot put that in your top three.
Don't give me subcategories here. I want your top three.
They destroyed the Colosseum, for God's sake.
And Mickey Wolf.
You got to go this movie, Hard Target, I think Time Cop, and I'm with Maka. It's a tie between Bloodsport and Kickboxer. But I will say this, if you ever need a good nap, the best Jean-Claude Van Damme movie is Cyborg.
Oh, gosh. What was that one with Maximum Risk with Natasha?
Yeah, that's quite a good little movie. Sleepy hit that one.
You know, the fighting films weren't necessarily my favorite. They were enjoyable, but I always got Bloodsport and what was it? The other one,
Kickboxer,
mixed up, you know. But for me, it's Time Cop, it's Hard Target, and I'm a huge fan. It is a big guilty pleasure of mine. I love Double Impact when he plays the twins. You know.
Forgetting one here. We're forgetting one classic.
What's that?
Die Hard in the skating rink.
Oh, sudden death.
I'm sorry. That movie sucked.
Yeah.
Okay.
That movie was a big letdown for me.
Okay, no. Come on.
That movie was good.
If you want to go, like, we all have our guilty pleasure Jean-Claude Van Damme film. You know, we know it's bad, but we still like it for whatever reason. Come on. Lionheart.
Oh, wrong bet.
Yeah.
Hey,
Lionheart, they look like they're saying you're pregnant or something.
you got to put Bloodsport and Lionheart or whatever you want to call it and Kickboxer kind of in the same vein, aren't they?
I put Nowhere to Run higher than those, man.
Oh, yeah.
What are we
Desert got? Heat.
Oh, that's the classic.
We're doing that here.
Desert Heat.
Directed by the director of Rocky and Karate Kid.
And you get Danny Trejo and Van Damme in the same film.
Robert G. Evans.
Which film was that?
Inferno/Desert Heat. It might be called Inferno.
It's the one where he gets his bike stolen by the hillbillies.
And you get Danny
Trejo. Hey, that's John Wick.
John Wick!
He got his bike stolen in the desert. He is John Wick in the desert.
And he calls it his pooch in there. See, it's a dog. Get it?
Oh.
He called it the pooch. I lost my pooch.
Australian stretch, share.
There was another director. There was another direct-to-video Van Damme film that I actually kind of liked, but I don't think it holds up, and that's Replicant.
Oh, Replicant.
That's good.
Oh, wow.
And he plays the crazy psychopathic.
Yeah.
But we cannot not talk about Jean-Claude Van Damme without talking about one of his greatest television appearances of all time, because it happened after Friends. The Super Bowl, and that was in Friends, where he played himself.
But he also did it in is it Las Vegas with Jimmy Kahn came on there and did like he was I'm filming a movie.
Did you guys like him in Street Fighter?
I can't get myself to watch Street Fighter. That's the problem. No.
I think Damien Chapa was
all right. Let's have a talk about the comedy. Welcome to the Jungle 2013.
Yes, Welcome to the Jungle.
Did you watch that one?
Have not no. seen that.
But what about what about when he played a bad guy in Black Eagle, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh. Enemies Closer as well.
Yeah.
Maybe he should have been a ninja assassin. You just rock up and take on Shokasugi.
Oh, my God. Did anybody know this? He was the voice of Master Croc in Kung Fu Panda 2.
I just found out he was a spectator. He was an uncredited extra in the movie Breakin' in 1984.
Oh, the canon film, yeah.
The hardcore.
The hardcore one. You haven't seen that? That's right, with the British Arnie. There's a British Arnie in that one.
In Hell?
In Hell, that's another
Derailed.
One. Oh, Die Hard on a Train with Van Damme.
There's Inferno. Eddie Lomax, 1999 was Inferno or Desert Heat, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
Hmm. I've You'll got more Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Knock off. Legionnaire.
Legion.
What
that was a great one.
This little cameo in the last action hero.
Yep.
I liked his run as the bad guy. Was it Expendables 2, I think he was?
Yeah.
Villain. My name is Villain.
Villain. Hey. He was in Missing in Action.
Yeah, he was
like uncredited as a soldier, Missing in Action.
He was Chuck Norris's stunt double back then and also karate trainer.
No Retreat, No Surrender.
I remember that one.
Did you imagine if Chuck took the titles of his movies? Chuck Sport, Chuck Boxer, Chuck Borg, Nowhere to Chuck.
Well, that's about the... Yeah, but there's that
replicant one. Yeah. That was kind of a comeback for him, wasn't it, back in the 90s? Mm. It was big European money behind that movie to really put him out there. It was one of the – Ringo Lam, I think, did that one. If I remember. Ringo Lam was the director that did Maximum Risk.
Here we go. This must have been a cameo. The Secret Adventures of Gustav Klopp.
Anybody watch that? I remember not seeing that.
Crickets.
Until Death.
It might be time to say goodbye now.
That's it.
But before we wrap, final thoughts on this movie. Look, I think it's one of my favorite Van Dammes. Is it number one? Probably not. But I think it's his most memorable. Brad, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, it's not his most memorable for me, but it's one of his most different. I think it's one of his most stylish. It's one of his most, surely one of his most entertaining ones that you can just sit and watch. And not expect too much. I think it's shot well. The action's great. I wouldn't put it in as my number one either. Mm. But, definitely up there.
Yeah, Cole?
It's in the top three. I don't know if I could put it in as number one. There's a lot of his movies I need to go back and revisit. But it's in the top three. I think it's probably one of his most memorable performances for a lot of the general public. So.
Definitely. I think it's in my top three, definitely. But I seem to remember too at the time that as big as Van Damme was, if you're a fan of action movies, I thought that in a way the other biggest star in this film was John Woo. You know, and I know that a lot of hardcore John Woo fans felt a little disappointed that this was his American debut. But I think he stepped it up when it came to Face Off. Face Off, to me, is his best American production, and it was a great film, great cast, good story. And you got a little more John Woo action-type story, slow motion, whatever you want to – you got the doves, too. You got all the
needed stuff. To not use stunt doubles with beards.
Yeah, exactly. But I hold this movie close to my heart. It's one of my guilty pleasures, and I think it's one of Jean-Claude Van Damme's most iconic looks. You know, when you look at his IMDb picture, it's a shot from this film. You know, when you got that great mullet that's always wet. You know, and he looked good. And he looked good in this film. He was charismatic, and he definitely carried this film.
That's right. If you stay around for Time Cop, you'll get even more mullet, except it's dry this time. Yeah. He decided to leave the hairdressers behind. So
Marty McMullet.
Well, yeah. Do you think about it? So I want to thank our team here today at Phantom Podcast Network for joining us all to chat about one of the greatest unsung action movies that ever came about in the 90s. And stay tuned, listeners. I want you to check us out after we leave. A little promo we've got together. We want you to check out all the many shows here on the network. And, of course, be sure to check them out. And maybe even a bit of Lethal Mullet. You might just enjoy that one too. These guys you'll catch on there guesting from time to time. And we're going to do more and more Couch Potato Theatre for here at Phantom Podcast Network. So
big Lorenzo La Mullet.
Lorenzo La Mullet. Yeah, we're going to do that one. So a big thanks to Kev, Kyle, Macca, and some bald fella. We will catch you very soon on Phantom Podcast Network.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal Podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal Podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.